Welcome back to Brainwaves. I'm Jim Siegler. In episode 5, I talked about 5 minutes on the localization of foot drop. So today we're going to be moving up the body and talking about a hopefully much simpler topic. And I say simpler because the brachial plexus is much simpler than the lumbosacral plexus. I mean, did you ever have to physically draw out the lumbosacral plexus? No. Right? No. Of course you didn't. But to pass Anatomy 101, everybody had to and can draw the brachial plexus. In this week's Brainwaves, I'll quickly review the fundamentals of the upper extremity exam, and in particular, the motor evaluation of a patient with wrist drop. At first, I thought I was going to be doing this show on my own, but I thought I'd ask my friend Dr. Laura Minardi to give me a hand.
That was so bad.
Thank you, Dr. Siegler.
Okay. So, quickly to review the anatomy of wrist drop as we get started, let's start with the radial nerve, which is supplied by all three trunks of the brachial plexus. The upper, C5, C6, the middle, C7, and the lower, C8 and T1 trunks. Together, these three trunks merge to form the posterior cord, a large bundle of axons that sprout three branches. The upper subscapular nerve, which innervates the subscapularis, the lower subscapular nerve, which innervates the teres major, and the thoracodorsal nerve, which innervates the latissimus dorsi. Eventually, the posterior cord divides into its two final tributaries, the axillary nerve, known for its innervation of the deltoid and teres minor, and the radial nerve, which does a whole bunch of cool stuff. Now, all this is important in today's talk, so feel free to rewind to get back here if I quickly breeze over these nerves and their function down the way.
All this anatomy being said, one might assume that with isolated wrist drop, which is often due to a radial neuropathy, you could have a lesion in any of these roots or trunks of the brachial plexus. However, as we're going to discuss today, nothing could be further from the truth. So let's get started by discussing a patient with isolated wrist drop. 48-year-old woman comes into your clinic with the complaint of painless right hand weakness. She said that over the last 3 weeks, she has lost the ability to extend her right wrist. Her handwriting has deteriorated, and she has difficulty placing her hand on the steering wheel of the car. She has no other upper extremity weakness, no face or leg weakness, neck or arm pain, or other neurologic symptoms. When you examine her, what are the clinical features that give you the highest yield in localizing the lesion?
Confirming that the wrist extensor muscles, like the extensor carpi radialis brevis and longus, are weak is probably necessary to confirm what the patient's told you already. And it can be helpful to distinguish from non-organic causes of wrist weakness. But this has almost zero localizing value. These two muscles are supplied by the radial nerve, or the posterior interosseous branch of the radial nerve, with some patient-to-patient variability. Unlike the more distal muscles innervated by the radial nerve, the extensor carpi radialis muscles receive axons originating from the C6 and C7 roots, and therefore the upper and middle trunks. A rule of thumb you definitely want to take away from here is that, in general, the more proximal muscle groups are innervated by roots higher up in the brachial plexus, whereas more distal muscle groups are innervated by roots lower down in the brachial plexus. Consider the deltoid, for example. An axillary nerve-innervated proximal muscle, which, like the radial nerve, originates from the posterior cord, but the axillary nerve originates from the C5 and C6 roots and the upper trunk. Then consider the abductor pollicis brevis, a median nerve innervated distal muscle, which, like the radial nerve, is ultimately supplied by the C8-T1 roots of the lower trunk. Now back to our lady with the hand weakness. So confirming that the wrist extension weakness here is really not that helpful in localizing the lesion. At this point, the lesion, which we will assume is peripheral for the purpose of the episode, can be due to a C6 or C7 radiculopathy, an upper or middle trunk problem, a posterior cord lesion, or a peripheral radial neuropathy. Every neurologist may do their exam a little bit differently, so I'll just walk you through how we approach this chief complaint. We'll start proximally and then work our way distally.
It's important here to realize that over 90% of causes of peripheral nervous system disease are going to localize to the nerve roots or the peripheral nerves. Rarely will you encounter a patient with an isolated upper trunk or posterior cord lesion, but this is what the board exams like to test you on, so you gotta know it. So that being said, how can we tell if the wrist drop is due to a C6 radiculopathy? Well, first of all, you shouldn't have complete paralysis of wrist extension with just a C6 root process. But there are some examination techniques you can do to rule this out. To start, you'll want to isolate a muscle group that is innervated by a nerve that originates at the C6 root, but not the posterior cord or radial nerve. If you look at the chart by Preston and Shapiro, which I copied onto our website, brainwaves.me, you'll find that the deltoid is not a great muscle to test in this circumstance because it does not distinguish C6 from posterior cord here, since the deltoid is innervated by the axillary nerve. The biceps brachii, however, is innervated by the musculocutaneous nerve, which comes off C5-C6 root and the lateral cord. Since we, as neurologists, are all like Sherlock Holmes here, by process of deduction, weakness in the biceps and wrist extensors must localize to either the C6 root or upper trunk. So, you, as the astute neurologist, test your patient's bicep strength with the forearm completely supinated, and it's normal. Now, this is definitely not a C6 or upper trunk process, so check that box off.
Next, can a wrist extension weakness be due to a C7 radiculopathy? Well, let's find a muscle innervated by a nerve originating from the C7 root and not the posterior cord or the radial nerve. The pronator teres is a great option here. It's innervated by the median nerve coming off the lateral and medial cords, and it originates at the C6 and C7 roots. So you give your patient a good strong handshake and check for wrist pronation, and voila, she pronates perfectly well, so it's not a C7 radic.
Moving distal to the roots, a lesion of the upper or middle trunks can cause slight wrist drop. To exclude an upper trunk lesion, we can isolate a nerve coming from the upper trunk, like the suprascapular nerve, which innervates the supraspinatus and infraspinatus. As you know, the supraspinatus provides the first 15 degrees of shoulder abduction, followed by the deltoid and lastly the trapezius. The infraspinatus, on the other hand, is the principal external rotator of the shoulder, so you test external rotation here, which is normal, not an upper trunk lesion.
Can it be a middle trunk lesion?
It can't be, since the middle trunk is supplied solely by the C7 root and we exclude a C7 radiculopathy. It can't be a middle trunk problem.
So we can continue to move more distally, where the wrist extension weakness can be due to a posterior cord problem. So we need to distinguish a radial neuropathy from a posterior cord lesion. And while I told you earlier that testing deltoid function does not offer much localizing value in distinguishing a C6 radiculopathy from a posterior cord lesion, it's the best way to distinguish a posterior cord lesion from a peripheral radial neuropathy. So you ask your patient to abduct her arm at the shoulder to 90 or 120 degrees, and she does this without difficulty. So it's not a posterior cord problem. This leaves us with a radial neuropathy or something more distal, like a posterior interosseous neuropathy. Let's continue to work our way distally and figure it out.
Even though we are already at the level of the peripheral nerve and exiting the brachial plexus, we've only made it a few inches away from the cervical spine. As the nerve dives into the axilla, it gives branches to the triceps brachii and a sensory branch called the posterior cutaneous nerve to the back of the upper arm. Axillary compression, usually in the setting of inappropriate use of the crutches or more rarely tumors, will cause weakness of all muscles innervated by the radial nerve, including the triceps, and sensory loss to much of the posterior upper extremity. But your lady does not have triceps weakness, so there's no axillary compression of the radial nerve. Even more distally, as everyone remembers from medical school, a lesion of the spiral groove of the humerus will obviously preserve strength at the triceps, but will cause weakness of all other radial nerve innervated muscles. The spiral groove is the most common site of injury of the radial nerve. The classic example is a Saturday night palsy, but it can also be due to a humeral fracture, muscle strain, or other causes of peripheral neuropathy like lead poisoning in kids or vasculitis. Patients are left with weakness of wrist extension in addition to finger extension due to paralysis of the extensor indices proprius, extensor digitorum communis, extensor carpi ulnaris, and long head of the extensor carpi radialis. They have mild weakness of forearm supination from supinator weakness, and they have mild weakness of elbow flexion from weakness of the brachioradialis. In some cases of radial neuropathy, the patient may be confused to have a coexisting ulnar neuropathy because finger abduction may appear weak. You should adjust for this by having the patient place her hand on a flat surface in order to isolate the dorsal interossei and confirm the ulnar nerve is intact. It is also important to realize here that many of the sensory nerve fibers from the radial nerve have already branched out, with the exceptions of the superficial radial sensory nerve, which innervates the dorsum of the hand and the proximal four fingers.
I would also add that a lesion of the posterior interosseous nerve, also called the deep radial motor nerve, can cause a similar dysfunction to that of a lesion at the spiral groove. But there's one muscle here that you can test that may help you distinguish a neuropathy of the PIN from that of the radial nerve at the spiral groove. It's the brachioradialis. So put your patient's arm in a partially pronated position and have her flex at the elbow. You may either see or feel the brachioradialis muscle contract with elbow flexion, and that will confirm a lesion of the PIN. Less importantly, a lesion at the takeoff of the PIN will allow for some preservation of wrist extension, due to the fact that the extensor carpi radialis muscles are supplied in part by the radial nerve before it branches to the PIN. There's also no sensory disturbance in a posterior interosseous neuropathy because the superficial radial sensory branch has already deployed. So what did our patient end up having, Laura?
She had isolated paralysis of the wrist extensors with mild weakness of forearm supination and elbow flexion in the pronated position, and finally preservation of tricep strength. There was no patchy area of numbness overlying the dorsal part of the hand in the distribution of the superficial radial sensory nerve. So all this is consistent with a radial motor neuropathy at about the level of the spiral groove, but it developed subacutely without any evidence of compression. On a more thorough neurologic examination, she had brisk reflexes in the biceps, brachioradialis, and triceps bilaterally, with some atrophy in the first dorsal interosseous muscle of the opposite hand. An EMG was done a week later and confirmed features consistent with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis.
What an incredible case. Thanks so much for walking us through it, Dr. Mainardi. I appreciate your help here.
Thank you so much, Jim.
That's all we've got for you this week. I'm Jim Siegler for Brainwaves. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Brainwaves today. If you like what you just heard, you can find more related material on the web at brainwaves.me or find us on Twitter at brainwavesaudio. Feel free to contact us at bweditorialboard@gmail.com. Be sure to check out our iTunes archive for older episodes. This episode was produced by Jim Siegler. Music by Josh Woodward. The Advent Chamber Orchestra. I'm Erica Mejia. Join us next time for another edition of Brainwaves.